Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to look at the battles in the Pacific on the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, and the significance of both those campaigns. So, following the devastation wrought upon Japan at the Battle of Midway, the next phase of the war focused to the south, the South Pacific, and the defence of Australia. The plan that Japan was now forced to embrace following the devastation of her carrier group in the Pacific and the failure to lure the American Pacific Fleet into a final battle, a final trap, was to prevent mass troop build-ups in Australia and to prevent Australia from becoming an American staging post for the reconquest of Southeast Asia and the Pacific. There was never much intention by the Japanese to physically invade Australia. It was too great a commitment of troops, the Australian continent being far too big, and having too little strategic purpose as far as Japan's wider interests go. Japan would have been hard-pressed to commit enough soldiers there and also to continue a war in mainland China. So instead, simply strangling Australia would be the preferred strategy. This meant occupying the Solomon Islands, Fiji, and other strategic outposts in the Pacific so that any sea lane into Australia could be cut off. Airfields were busily being built on islands like Tulagi, and there was a large naval base at Rabaul. And this meant that Australia came under great threat of strangulation. There was an ongoing debate, an ongoing historiographical debate for many years as to Japanese intentions towards Australia. And that argument really was concluded with the idea that Japan had no intention of a physical land invasion, though there was a great deal of anxiety in Australia at the time that this might be possible. So the scene of fighting would be in New Guinea along the Kokoda Trail from the north side of the island down to Port Moresby on the south, and it would be in the Solomon Islands at Guadalcanal. and the fighting was particularly fierce in both these campaigns because the Japanese knew the stakes involved. Japan had made now two key missteps. Firstly, not destroying the US carrier fleet at Pearl Harbor, and then secondly, allowing its codes to be broken and for the trap that it had tried to set at Midway being reversed and instead falling into a US trap. Now, after 6 months of success, Japan would be fighting a defensive war, and its defensive line would be drawn in the islands closest to Australia. So, as we normally do when we're looking at the general history of the Second World War, we look at Max Hastings' All Hell Let Loose. It's a very good general standard account of the war. And on the subject of Guadalcanal and New Guinea, he writes, "The next phase of the Pacific campaign was driven by expediency and characterised by improvisation. The US, committed to Germany first, planned to dispatch most of its available troop strength to fight in North Africa. MacArthur in Australia lacked men to launch the assault on Rabaul, which he favoured. Instead, Australian troops, slowly reinforced by Americans, were committed to frustrate Japanese designs on the vast jungle island of Papua New Guinea. Separated from the northern tip of Australia by only 200 miles of sea, this became seen to one of the grimmest struggles of the war." Now, there's some interesting stuff to unpack there right away. So the secondary campaign of the war at this point was the Pacific. The first priority was Europe. The US army was committed to the Hitler First strategy, and the Navy and the Marines were waging war in the Pacific against Japan. It would be unfair to say that this for America was a sideshow, but it certainly was a secondary issue, particularly for Roosevelt. There were those amongst his chiefs of staff, particularly Admiral King, the head of the Navy, who were Anglo-sceptic, to say the least, if not actually Anglophobic, who saw that America's war lay in the Pacific, also he believed, and it was not the responsibility of America to help the British retain what was left of their empire, which is what many sceptical-minded American servicemen and chiefs of staff suspected was Britain's interest in America's contribution to the war. So the more focus there was on the Pacific, the more campaigns that were actually waged in the Pacific, the happier chiefs of staff like King actually were. And there were plenty of military figures, senior military figures, in the Pacific and Southeast Asia Command who held similar views of the British. Amongst many American servicemen, SEAC, Southeast Asia Command, was dubbed Saving England's Asian Colonies. So there was antipathy there. MacArthur, of course, was in Australia, having fled from the island of Corregidor and leaving his troops to be captured and to die in large numbers on the Bataan Peninsula in the Philippines. He was ordered to evacuate, which he did all too readily, dumping the blame for the defeat and the surrender on his subordinates. And he lived a rather glamorous lifestyle in Australia, when he became something of a media darling, both in the Australian press and in the American press. And he was later highly disparaging of the the Australian soldiers who fought along the Kokoda Trail, the famous diggers, whose courage was unquestionable, and whose contribution to the fighting and to this pivotal battle in the war was really absolutely first rate. Wherever you look at Australian soldiers throughout the Second World War, and also New Zealanders, their tenacity as fighting troops is really quite astounding, and their contribution to campaigns often is really, really pivotal. So MacArthur, a man of extraordinary ego and questionable talent, was cast quite a long shadow over the entire campaign. So, looking into Hastings again, he writes: "Meanwhile, 600 miles eastwards in the Solomons, Japan, who had occupied Tulagi Island, moved on to the neighbouring Guadalcanal, where they began to construct an airfield. If they were allowed to complete and exploit this, their planes could dominate the region. An abrupt American decision was made to preempt them by landing the 1st Marine Division. Such a stroke fulfilled the US Navy's driving desire, promoted by Admiral Ernest King in Washington, to engage the enemy wherever opportunity allowed. The Marines were staging throughout Wellington, New Zealand, en route to an undecided objective. They found themselves ordered to restow their ships for an immediate assault landing. When the local dock labour force refused to work in prevailing heavy rain, Marines did the job themselves. Then in the first days of August 1942, they sailed for Guadalcanal. In their innocence, many supposed that they were destined to wage war in a tropical paradise." The Guadalcanal campaign begins slowly, curiously slowly. The Marines came ashore to comparatively little artillery fire and gunfire, and believed that they'd seized a major victory with comparative ease. Of course, the Japanese occupiers had retreated deep into the island and would wage a very long jungle warfare campaign. Max Hastings writes: "On the 7th, 19,000 American troops landed first on the outlying islands, then on Guadalcanal proper, in the face of a slight opposition following a heavy naval bombardment. In the dirty dawn, there were only a few fires flickering, like the city dumps, to light our path to history," wrote Marine Robert Leckie. Robert Leckie was featured in the Spielberg series The Pacific. He was one of the kind of prolific soldier journalists of the campaign. Australian Coast Watcher Captain Martin Clements watched exultantly from his jungle hideout as the Americans came ashore, writing in his diary, "Wizard, canoe, Calais, oh what a day. On the beach, men vastly relieved to find themselves alive, split coconuts and gorging on the milk, heedless of implausible warnings that the Japanese might have poisoned them. Then they began to march inland, soon parched and sweating prodigiously. The Japanese, following another huge intelligence failure, had not anticipated the Americans' arrival. In what would prove a critical action of the Pacific War, the landing force quickly seized the airstrip, christened it Henderson Field in honour of a Marine pilot hero of Midway. Some men liberated caches of enemy supplies, including sake, which allowed them to become gloriously drunk during the nights that followed. Thus ended the last easy part. What followed became one of the most desperate campaigns of the Far Eastern War, characterised by small but bloody battles ashore, repeated clashes of warships afloat."
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Marines on Guadalcanal found themselves stranded when the Japanese swept in behind the invasion fleet and sank most of it. The bay where the Marines came ashore became known as Iron Bottom Sound, and the Marines who had landed came to essentially awoke the next day after a titanic battle at sea to realise that the island was surrounded by enemy warships, that troops could be easily landed now, enemy troops could easily be landed, and that resupply was very, very unlikely for some time. This humiliation took place 2 days after the landing. Admiral Fletcher, who we heard about when we talked about Midway, had signalled to Nimitz that he thought that local Japanese air power was a huge threat to the three carriers that sat off the coast. He recommended that they were withdrawn, and without waiting for approval, he set a course northwestwards. Rear Admiral Kelly Turner, that commanded the transports inshore, said that this was a dereliction of duty and used the term desertion. Fletcher's reputation for what happened next never really fully recovered. It could be argued that it was entirely the right thing to do, because not only would the landing fleet have been destroyed, but also the carrier group as well. In the early hours of the 9th of August, the surprise attack happened, which revealed a kind of a great deal of incompetence as far as the Americans went, but also it reminded the Americans that one of the things that the Japanese were very good at was night fighting at sea. Japanese Vice Admiral Gunichi Mikawa led a heavy cruiser squadron in an attack on the offshore anchorage, which was protected by one Australian and four American heavy cruisers, together with five destroyers. The enemy ships had been spotted the previous afternoon by an RAF Hudson, a Royal Australian Air Force Hudson bomber, but its sighting report was not picked up at Fall River on New Guinea because the radio station was shut down during an air raid. Even when the Hudson landed, there was an inexcusable delay of several hours before word was passed on to the warships at sea. The Americans were deployed off Savo Island in anticipation of Japanese strike. The column steamed undetected through the Western Destroyer radar picket line. Within 3 minutes of the Americans belatedly spotting the Chokai, the leading Japanese ship, the Australian cruiser Canberra was struck by at least 24 shells, which detonated, in the words of a survivor, with a terrific orange-green flash. Every man in the boiler room was killed and the power was lost. The Canberra was unable to fire a shot during the subsequent hours before being abandoned. There is some evidence that the cruiser was also hit by a torpedo from the American destroyer Bagling, which was aimed at the Japanese. The American destroyer Patterson was in a perfect firing position, but during the deafening concussion of the guns, the ship's torpedo officer failed to hear the captain's order to trigger the tubes. At 1:47 a.m., two Japanese torpedoes hit the USS Chicago. Only one of these exploded in the bow, but it crippled the ship's fire control system. The Astoria fired 13 salvos without any effect because the commander of the Astoria failed to see Mikawa's ships and the gunnery radar was defective. The cruiser was wrecked by Japanese gunfire at a range of 3 miles and abandoned the next day with heavy loss of life. The Vincennes was devastated and already on fire when her armament began to shoot. Her commanding officer, Captain Frederick Riefskoll, had no idea that the enemy was attacking and supposed himself to be the victim of friendly fire. And Mikawa lit up the battlefield, the sea battlefield, with searchlights that illuminated the Vincennes. And Riefskoll, the captain of the Vincennes, believed this, again, to be a friendly ship and broadcast angrily over the radio, demanding that the lights be switched off. And then he spent the next few minutes in blind panic, trying to save his ship as the realisation occurred that this was not friendly fire. And by that point, it was too late. The USS Quincy then fired star shells, which were designed essentially kind of flares to illuminate the battlefield. And they burst over the low cloud. But unfortunately, Japanese seaplanes dropped illumination flares beyond the American squadron, which silhouetted the ships so that there were outlines for the Japanese to aim at. The Quincy was destroyed, the captain was killed, and the order was given to try to beach the ship. The ship sank with the loss of 370 officers and men. The Chokai suffered only one hit in its staff chart room. So, after this devastating victory, the Japanese ceased fire at 2:16 a.m. And there was now a debate about whether to press on the attack against the American transports off Guadalcanal. Mikawa decided it was too late to regroup the squadron to make such an assault, and then withdrew before daylight out of range of the American carrier aircraft, which he assumed, incorrectly, were close at hand. Amid the kind of the carnage and the fire and the tropical rainstorm that followed, the Japanese withdrew, and the chaos that was kind of that perpetuated continued until the dawn. An American destroyer fired 106 5-inch shells at a cruiser before discovering it was the Canberra. And when it was decided the Australian warship must be sunk, US destroyers fired a further 370 rounds into the hulk before it began to sink to the bottom. The only consolation for the Allies was an American sub torpedoed and sank the Kano, which was one of Mikawa's heavy cruisers, during its withdrawal after the action. So, in the at Guadalcanal, Admiral Turner continued to offload supplies for the Marines until the 9th, where it was decided that it was too dangerous and the landing fleet had to withdraw. Turner wrote about the hubris of the Navy. He said, "The Navy was still obsessed with a strong feeling of technical and mental superiority over the enemy. In spite of ample evidence as to the enemy capabilities, most of our officers and men despised the enemy and felt themselves sure victors in all encounters under any circumstances. The net result of all of this was a fatal lethargy of mind. We were not mentally ready for hard battle. I believe that this psychological factor as a cause of our defeat was even more important than the element of surprise." So the Navy learned its lessons. Never again in the war did it suffer such a severe humiliation. And the critical reality which soon dawned on the Japanese was that yet again one of their admirals had allowed caution to deprive him of a chance to convert success into a decisive strategic engagement. Had Mikawa continued and sunk the landing fleet, then it's entirely possible that the Marines would have been forced to surrender on Guadalcanal. But because that didn't happen, the Marines were in a position with enough supplies to carry on fighting and have enough offloaded from the ships to before there had to be a withdrawal. So much as with Pearl Harbor, a decisive attack wasn't quite turned into enough of a victory to make the position of the enemy untenable. The Japanese themselves were slow on the uptake when it came to understanding what the Americans wanted in Guadalcanal and how much they wanted it. The importance of Guadalcanal to the Japanese was clear. They didn't quite understand how much the Americans would fight for it. They sent reinforcements bit by bit to the island. By this point, obviously, Japan has a huge drain on its manpower, huge kind of demands on its manpower all across Southeast Asia and the Pacific. They were not only parsimonious with the troops that they sent, but those that they sent, they actually flung into battle as if they had troops to spare. They used frontal attacks, each of them insufficiently powerful to break through the marine perimeters. The Americans who held Henderson Field, which is the most important site on the island, and the surrounding tropical rainforest found themselves locked in this endless struggle with the Japanese. Visibility was low amongst an impenetrable tangle of rainforest, and often battles would be fought hand-to-hand with groups of enemy soldiers surprising each other at very short difference. And of course the intense humidity and tropical diseases took their toll on American troops. Okay, so we're going to finish there and we'll look at the next part of that campaign and also the Papua New Guinea campaign and the Kokoda Trail next time. I hope you find this handy and useful and look forward to catching you on the next Explaining History podcast. Come over and find us at the Explaining History Facebook group, or if you can support us on Patreon, then you know where to look. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.